We're very happy to see so many people here, and I would like to give some credit to people and organizations that made this possible. I don't think we would really be able to be doing this without a partial funding from the Florida Endowment for the Humanities, for which we're very grateful. And we also thank the Florida Folklore Society for their part in sponsoring this. My name is Dale Olson. I'm president of the Folklore Society of Florida. And we're also very grateful to the Historical Museum of Southern Florida, Randy Nimnicht, director, executive director, for hosting this and making use of their quarters here. And we thank Tina Bukovalas especially for her wonderful local arrangements. Also, the Bureau of Florida Folklife Programs for technical assistance, Orman Loomis, director of that, and especially Yvonne Bryant, who's sitting back there at the table taking our money, and Nancy News and Nancy Michael. And finally, Stetson Kennedy for organizing the concept or thinking of the concept and coordinating the speakers, and Peggy Bulger as well. Some of you have a project evaluation form in your packet that looks something like this. Since we are being funded partially by the Florida Endowment for the Humanities, they ask that there are at least, 10 of these that are filled out. So would you please, during the course of today's conference, be filling that out and turn that in to either Nancy, Michael, Nancy, everybody know this is Nancy back here, or Tina Bukovalas. Tina is right back here also. Or just simply give them to me and I'll pass them on. Also, we will have a lunch on your own and dinner on your own. Now, if you are from out of town and do not know the area, Elizabeth Stevens has offered her guidance. She has a car, and some of us can, of course, walk to places in the area. So we can sort of congregate after the speakers for lunch if we'd like to go together.
Dale,
yes.
In the packets, there's a list that Tina put together of restaurants right within walking distance.
Okay. You have a list of restaurants within walking distance. Okay, our first speaker, we will find, I think, as you get up here, that in order to be heard using this PA system, you have to be about that far away from the microphone. So I would ask simply that speakers speak very loudly if you don't use this. Stetson Kennedy is our first speaker today. You have also in your packet a list of the biographies of our speakers, so I don't want to take the time to repeat that. I'll just simply repeat the first sentence or some of the vital information. Stetson Kennedy, if you are wondering about his past, he's plastered up there on these facsimiles of newspaper articles, and it's fascinating reading. Pictures of him back in the 30s doing the collecting and really... Mr. Folklore, I think, of Florida in many ways, author of Palmetto County and Country, and a number of other important books. So Stetson Kennedy probably really needs no introduction, so I'll just ask him to stand up here. He will be he's our current president-elect of the society, and as of tomorrow will be our president. So president-elect Stetson Kennedy.
Well, anyone ever tell you you're a beautiful audience? Folklore seems to attract only beautiful people. It's my experience. Can you hear me without the microphone? Rather than trying to hold it, I'd rather not. Can you hear me in the back?
No.
Cannot hear.
Here. I'll just adjust.
I really wish, you know, my disc goes out if I stand in one place for a long time. Let me try sitting down with it.
Okay.
With your indulgence, will that be all right?
That'd be
fine. Uh-huh. I'll just get your...
There.
How about that?
That's good.
Yeah, it seems to me that any symposium on the subject of collecting folklore in Florida ought to begin with a word at least of tribute to those who came before us in the WPA. There were some really giants in the field. before we got there. And first and foremost among these, I think we should name Zora Hurston and Marjorie Rawlings, who did such a job with both the white and black folk life of the state, immortalizing it, really. And then there were the Lomaxes, the father and son, John and Alan. I don't believe John and Alan have arrived yet, but he will. There you are. will be with us on stage before the morning's over. I won't try to get into what they did in Florida. He will do that. They did a great deal, I can assure you. Then there was Alton Morris at Gainesville, who spent decades as editor of the Southern Folklore Quarterly, and his book of Florida folk songs is a monumental contribution. Ralph and Edna Boggs, where we were entertained so cordially last night, likewise. If it were not for the fact that folk culture were inexhaustible, I would say that they had done an exhaustive study of the Latin culture of Ybor City and Florida Latins generally, as well in other parts of the hemisphere. And the name of Francis Densmore, who did a volume on Seminole Indians in the early 30s before we arrived, and went back in 54 with sponsorship by the University of Florida. And of course, our esteemed colleague, Russell Reaver, whose volume on Florida folktales has recently been published. It's not pioneer in point of time, perhaps, but certainly pioneer in terms of getting Florida folk tales into print between two covers, all major contributions before our field workers of the WPA went into the field in 1935. The symposium is titled In the Nick of Time. I'm afraid that's my doing. Some of our academic friends complained about the language, but it seemed to me that for a folk conference, a folksy title would be all right. And by the nick of time, we of course meant the fact that the old Florida was fast disappearing in the mid-30s. There was the pioneer Florida, which had existed since the white man, after the Spaniards left and the crackers came in with the blacks, and of course there were blacks here before that. But in any case, the pioneer Florida, which had existed up until the mid-30s, no electricity in the countryside, dirt roads, outhouses, no running water in the homes by virtue of no electricity, 100% pellagra in the countryside. At some time during your lifetime, if you lived in the country, you had to have, I said pellagra, I meant hookworm. That, of course, by virtue of going to and from the outhouse barefoot. The spectacle of the at twilight, the horizon being tinted a rosy hue from the firemen out burning, greening up the woods, as they called it. So the cattle, Florida was open range, and the cattle would bed down on the highways at night. What few highways we had, they would seek them out and sleep on them at night because the sun had warmed the bricks, kept them warm in the nighttime, causing no end of mayhem on the highways. The mule was, of course, the centerpiece of rural life in those days. The tractor was on the way, but had not really arrived. John Henry was just about to lay down his hammer and die in deference to the steam hammer. And all of these other symbols of that old Florida were just beginning to go out when we took the field. And it was, among other things, of course, there was the oral tradition. In that Florida, oral tradition was strong. And with the coming of the printed word, illiteracy was high, so the printed word didn't have much impact on a lot of people. But and there was a further saying that not many of them folks can read, but them what can don't, was one of the sayings of the time. So even what little literacy we had didn't make that much difference. And before leaving my thumbnail sketch of that Florida, I ought to to mention, too, the fact that it was an apartheid Florida. The Jim Crow system was everywhere. There was nothing you could do in private or public without paying deference to the American prototype of apartheid in the form of the Jim Crow system. Then, too, there was the fact that besides the vanishing of that Florida and the impact of World War II, which was just around the corner, there was the fact that the Great Depression was full upon us. And the 1930s census, in my estimation, was what you might call a revolutionary document in terms of the revolutionary conditions that it depicted. Florida was, 15 years later, the United Nations was to declare the entire South a major hunger area of the world. And during the Great Depression, if it was a hunger area later, it was a starvation area, certainly, in the 30s. Our field workers were bringing in stories, for example, of mothers taking their infants and turning them over to the family dog to suckle for lack of other nourishment in the family. Now, I won't try to get into depression. Some of you may have, I don't know if there's anyone here who lived through that one or not, but I see Charlie nodding his head vehemently. But it was not anything like the recessions which you've known. It was a worldwide calamity in which the system itself fell on its face, I should say face politely, and no one had any idea about how to get it back on its feet. And any of you might be looking for a subject for a thesis or dissertation might well look into the pronouncements made by presidents and kings and potentates in those days as to, you know, where do we go from here after a thing like this. And the French make their distinctions between a crisis of regime and a crisis constitutional. But our big depression and that world depression was a crisis of system. And I don't believe you'll find much about that in your history books. So that, as I say, it may well be a subject of interest to someone looking for a subject. Everyone was desperate. The folks say had it that those were the root hog or die days. And I think, as usual, folk says it more succinctly than anyone else. my own introduction to folklore, of course, at that time, Florida, and especially North Florida, was really South Georgia. And so that the culture which I was born into in 1916, black and white, came out of South Georgia by and large. And so I was no stranger to those cultures as a child, but it was probably in Robert E. Lee High School in Jacksonville that I first started making notes about folklore. It may have started when I dated a little girl from, I'd say, across the tracks, and we'd no sooner parked in Lover's Lane than she started saying things like, I ain't done nothing but catch hell since I was hatched. And what else did she say? Oh, so I've already done more living than you ever will. And of course, that sort of thing would make a fella stop and think, but not about romance. Huh? In addition to Robert E. Lee High School, my father had a furniture store, and I was called upon to collect. He had a large clientele called a dollar down and dollar a week. And it was almost a social service agency because all the young people didn't have jobs, didn't have money, and they wanted to get married and have homes and children. So they would come to the Kennedy Furniture Company with a dollar bill as a down payment and bought a house full of furniture, of course. And, but anyway, he would set them up in matrimony, and I would have to go out and collect the dollar a week. And I learned a great deal about black and white culture there. I recall picking up the phone one day, and there was a black woman's voice on the other end. She says, "Come get that bed you sold me yesterday." I said, "I'm a married woman, got a house full of children. I can't have no talking bed." So I made a note of that. My father, his competitor, said he was too good a Christian to be in the furniture business. And it's true that he was a tithing Baptist, if you ever heard of such a thing. I never had. But occasionally he would have to repossess the furniture, and this meant that I would get on a pickup truck with some other driver. And we would back up to the house without any formalities, and if there was food cooking on the stove or people in the bed, we just move both parties and haul the goods off hot, the stove and the bed. There was a shiffer robe. I don't know if anyone ever heard the word shiffer robe, but it's still in use or not, but one of the things we repossessed on one occasion was a shiffer robe. And I found in the drawer an unmailed letter the black mother had sent to her husband who'd been jailed for some reason or no reason. And the letter, I took the liberty of reading it and keeping it, as a matter of fact, said she was taking the kids home to her mother and turning back the furniture. And then she had a P.S. says, "Al, honey, I've done the best to know how." And it seemed to me like that always make a fitting epitaph for almost anyone. You end your message with, "I've done the best to know how." Anyway, my experiences with the furniture company were enough to make me see the justice of one of the ditties I collected in the process. If there ever was a devil born in the land, it must have been the furniture to a man. I went from Jacksonville to Gainesville briefly. Those were the days when the Axis was on the move, and I couldn't find any concern inside the Ivy Halls or outside, for that matter. And I was concerned, so I organized something called the Florida Intercollegiate Peace Council, which turned out to be the first interracial student group in the South. And instead of attending to my studies, and after about a year and a half, I decided the university really had nothing to offer me, and packed up and I sent a trunk load of books to Key West by water, and then hitchhiked to join it. And so that brought me to our southernmost city. I neglected to mention that nothing much of a folksy nature happened at Gainesville, unless it was the fact that this peace council, we went over to Tallahassee where all the girls were then, any number of lads being killed every weekend rushing to Tallahassee on the highway. But on this occasion, we built a bonfire on campus and persuaded some of the girls to peel off their Japanese silk panties and silk stockings and toss them on the fire on camera as a protest against Japan going into Manchuria. I suppose you could call that a folk way. I don't know whether it ever caught on or not. But in Key West, I don't believe the universities were into independent studies at that time, but this was the course I took. You could call it that, I suppose, sitting on the beach and reading. And I was startled by the discovery that there was anything else on the planet besides the Anglo-Black thing here in Florida. It was my first exposure to any other culture. And it had a lot to do with the way of looking at life, the Creole philosophy of life. Here they were starving to death but still having a ball. And that's, of course, quite a trick for any people who can get away with it. And it ought to say something to all of us, no matter what the economic situation at the time. But things like, it made me jump to such conclusions that we Nordics had the atrophy of our rumbling muscles, for example, that reached the hopeless stage, probably. Anyway, I made notes, married one of the girls. Her mother was Cuban, her father was Bahaman. I put in a good deal of volunteer time working on the beach with the FERA, which was a precursor to the WPA. And we were all planting coconuts along the highways to attract tourists. We couldn't imagine why anyone who, with Miami up the road, why anyone would want to come to Key West, but we planted a few coconuts in the hope that would attract somebody. And we raked up seaweed on the beach, which conveniently the tide brought in every 12 hours in a high tide. There was more seaweed to rake. And the decaying seaweed created a strong morisco, the sea breeze, fishy sea breeze. I recall one of the jokes told by the FERA workers. He had, at noontime when the whistle blew, he took a piece of Cuban bread and sliced it and held the two pieces up to the breeze out to sea, and then took it down and took a key lime, cut the lime in half and squeezed lime juice all over both pieces of bread and put it together and started eating. And workers came up and said, "What do you think you're doing?" And he said, "That's a sea breeze sandwich." And sandwich de marisco. So there was that kind of humor floating around to cope the hardships. I don't know whether I'm going to run out of time before I get well into the, I'd better back out of my own personal experiences, except to say that, well, quickly, at the wedding, it was a folk custom, in this particular wedding anyway, they took a case of Bacardi rum and dumped it into a punch bowl and served it straight to all the guests, with all the windows on the ground floor filled with kids holding tin cans and shouting, "Wrong, wrong, wrong." And if we didn't give them any, they were going to dial a lot to give us the can, the tin can serenade, the charivari, the same thing that the French did in Pensacola whenever the marriage was unseemly for any reason. I suppose in my own case, they thought we were too young to marry or something like that. But anyway, we gave them rum and they did not give us the latte. I went back to Gainesville University, and not having money to pay tuition, I audited journalism. There were no creative writing courses, but Marjorie Kellen Rawlings did come to town and had a brief course, which I attended, and strangely, I can't recall it, but I have correspondence and records. I was there, in other words. So perhaps it did me some good that I don't just not aware of, but she was a friend of a Francis Yule, who was a neighbor of mine and the mother of my classmate who went to Key West with me. And Mrs. Yule was at that time deputy director of all of the cultural projects in the state of Florida, which consisted of writers and theater, art, music, recreation, and later historical records. And it occurred to me that, as broke as I was, that I should ask her for a job with the Writers Project, which I did. And it was necessary to get a job with any WPA program to be certified as being eligible for relief. And for me, this was easy because all I had to do was swear that I had no money, no property, no job, and no prospect of getting any of those things. So I was fully qualified and got the job. And the job title was junior interviewer, and the pay was $37.50 every 2 weeks. This was the top pay in the state just for Duval. Oh, wait a minute, this was the last year at the time, so it was perhaps a few dollars higher in Duval. But this was $37.50 every 2 weeks, and I recall when the first check came, my wife and I went window shopping and wondering what in the world we're going to do with all that money. And we managed somehow. I was soon transferred to Jacksonville in a matter of months to Jacksonville to work with the state editorial staff. And the state office at that time was in the Dial Upchurch building, and the state director was Carita Doggett Corse, who was a friend of Mrs. Yule. And she was, I suppose, middle-aged at the time, a prominent Jacksonville family, and she had published a paper or two about the Minorcans, for one thing. And she was director from the first day of the Writers' Project in 1935 until its last in 43. She was a very vivacious person. She had a private office. The rest of us sat at wooden desks back to back in a large room, but she had a private office. And she would arrive at work beaming in the morning, and every time she popped out of her office during the day, she never just emerged. She always popped out. Beaming and still beaming at the end of the day. But in any case, she didn't do a great deal of writing, as I recall, but she was a meticulous editor and read every scrap of copy that came in from all over the state and made voluminous notations of editorial directives to us on the editorial staff about what to check out and elaborate upon. But she was a first-class administrator and kept morale pitch the whole time. In a matter of, while in Key West and getting married and so on, up until that time, I might mention I'd written poetry, but the first morning after the ceremony, and I picked up the tab for breakfast for two, I never wrote another verse. The bard went right out the window, and that was the end of my career as a poet, for better or worse. Where was I? Before the marriage, writing verse. The editors, there were six or eight state editors, and we knew we were editors because we all had a peanut jar or something full of pencils. There were oversized pencils which had written on them in large word letters the word editor. So we knew, and everyone else knew, that we were editors. And we had a large clerical typing pool. Statewide, the staff was pegged at something like 200. And of that 200, 10 was an authorized strength for what was called the Negro Unit. And the Negro Unit was stationed in the heart of the Jacksonville slum, and on Ashley Street, the bars and things all around, and itself in a mission. It was in the days before United Way, and this was the only place blacks could go for a meal. So that's where the Negro Unit held forth, and we never saw them. They never attended any of our editorial conferences, but they sent a messenger over every 2 weeks to pick up their checks. And that was the sort of arrangement we had there. In Key West, is what I was starting to say a moment ago, that in Key West I had done an inventory of Key West folklore, which Dr. Kaur sent on to Washington, and it caught the eye of Dr. Benjamin Botkin, who at that time was national director for folklore of the Writers Project. And to the extent that he recommended that I be put in charge of folklore collecting in Florida, and he got Dr. Royce, is it Merton Royce, who was in charge of social ethnic studies, as they were called, and Dr. W.T. Couch, director of Chapel Hill, the North Carolina Press, who was in charge of oral history collection for the project. And the three of them decided that I should head these things in Florida, which was approved. And so I had those three hats in addition to my editorial duties. Scattered throughout the state in this quota of some 200 workers, we had what were called field workers, and there were scores of them, and they reported to the various district offices, Jacksonville, Miami, Tampa, and Pensacola. And these field workers were, for the most part, housewives, with all due respect to housewives. They had not had a lot of formal education. Probably most had not completed high school. But they had a vast amount of enthusiasm and interest in their community and what the project was trying to do. And although they were working out of their homes for the most part and on their own bosses, they were extremely active and extremely diligent and extremely productive. And it's touched when I read about the professionally trained folklorist collectors who instructions on how to relate to these people. When in the case of the field workers on the Writers Project, this presented no problem whatever. They were related by virtue of culture and neighborhood and sometimes by family. So that literally all they had to do was knock on the door and the rapport was there. So from that point of view, and the point of view of their enthusiasm, you know, some of you may think you were the first professionals in folklore, but I assure you, even at 37.50 every 2 weeks, we were the first. As to the methodology followed in the collecting, we had the benefit of guidelines and forms produced by Botkin and Royce, which, in my opinion, were quite good for their time and served their purpose well. I stressed the importance in approaching a community to ascertain, first of all, you know, take me to your leader. If you knew who the principal person in terms of moral leadership, whether a minister or whatever, and went to that person and explained the importance of what you were trying to do and got permission to use their name as a reference and asked also for leads. All of those things would pay great dividends in terms of time and productivity, so that the moment you made reference to this community leader, then there were no more questions asked. It obviated all such questions about who you were and what you were up to. At the same time, I stress what I more recently coined the phrase of, that in all such communities, it seems there are what I would call ambulatory repositories, people who are walking around who've made a lifetime thing of absorbing every scrap of folklore that comes their way. And if you can identify such persons, you've really got it made in terms of tapping the folklore of that community. Invented. On the wall, you can see a photograph of the machine we did have. It was required some two men to carry it, and if you were working on a railroad track or on a pokey boat, you had to have another man to carry two automobile batteries. And it cut directly onto an acetate disc. And another, I suppose you would call it methodology, the matter of instant playback. We could do that even with this machine. And I had discovered that it was a tremendous turn-on to the informant if you would, without delay, play back their first few utterances. And the phenomenon of hearing their own voices for the first time, certainly no one else had such exposure in the 30s, it was sensational. And they became ham actors instantly, you know. Couldn't wait for you to turn the machine back on. But I recall we went first to the Negro. Well, no, the first thing we did with the machine when it was entrusted to us by the Library of Congress, and I believe Alan worked with the machine earlier, he and his father, same machine. But the first thing we did was get Zora Hurston into town and sit her down in the chair at the state office and see what we could get out of her. And one of the things, I think Halpert was there, but I believe I was asking the questions. And I asked her if she knew the song Uncle Bud. And she said, yes, I know it. And I said, well, what kind of song would you call it? She says, well, that's one of those juke songs. I said, what do you mean juke song? She said, well, a juke song is a song you wouldn't sing in front of nothing but a juke woman. And I said, well, you heard it? And she said, yes, I heard it. So she proceeded to sing it. I see I'm running beyond my time. Let me see what I can sum up with. It was Zora who had said that folklore is the boiled down juice or the pot liquor of human living. And was that note for me? I couldn't read it from back there. Yes, that's what I thought it said. And I thought she said it very well. And the material that Zora sent, when I talked about Zora, it's sometimes been billed as working with Zora, but I suggested to the sponsors that perhaps it should have been called trying to get Zora to work, because we had great difficulty at times. She worked out of our hometown of Eatonville, and it was difficult to get into it. My principal personal affinity for folklore has been based upon the manner in which it serves as a repository for wisdom, the accumulated wisdom in the culture, for wisdom for living, and the ability of the folk culture to say it in a very few words. And I believe it was Tolstoy who said that he preferred, when he had anything serious to discuss it with illiterate peasants, because their thinking processes and their speaking processes had not been obfuscated by formal training. And it occurred to me that Tolstoy should look up the old black fellow who said, when you're in Rome, Georgia, you got to act like it. And the black domestic who said, I feed the white folks with a long spoon. And finally, the fellow who said, when you ain't got no education, you got to use your brain. I'll conclude as rapidly as possible on the note that on culture and government and culture, public sector support of culture. From the point of view, my credentials are that you might say that I ate the cake in my 5 years in the WPA and its efforts in the cultural field. We all know that what we call primitive societies devote a vast amount of their resources and time and talent to the cultivation and preservation of their cultures. And yet, and we know how in the Middle Ages and when empires and cities arose, how some people supported a few, some architects and artists, but that the popular culture was left to take care of itself. And in modern industrial urban society, what has happened as a result of the printed word and the electronic media in terms of cutting, severing our umbilical cord to our past and the wisdom for living which folk culture represents, and the social and consequences of that severance. It seems to me that the endowment for the humanities and the arts have arrived at a formula quite different from that of the writers' projects and the other cultural projects of WPA, a formula which calls for the combination of federal and state and local funds and private and public funds generally, with the allocation of those funds being determined by boards of citizens on a state level. It seems to me that this is a path which we may all want to see augmented. At the same time, it would behoove us, I think, to make certain that as we augment the role of government in culture, that we see to it that our society is one which is truly of, by, and for the folk. In other words, it makes all the difference whether Franklin Roosevelt or an Adolf Hitler is the head of state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stetson. That was a wonderful introduction to the project and to Florida folklore and collecting.